Good morning. Everybody doing good today? Yeah, I think everybody slept in or is out hiking or fishing this morning, right? Yeah, that's what the afternoons are for, guys. Well, like Matt said, we are in week three of our series, Unnatural. And we could take this series and we could talk about it for the rest of the year. Because being unnatural is what we are called to be. But we are kind of skimming the surface of this topic. What I want to challenge you guys to do is I want you guys to start reading your Bibles with unnatural eyes. So start looking at things in your Bible that seem unnatural. So we're teaching you the concepts, we're teaching you the idea, but you can take this so much further. And it really does change the way that you hear even worship music, the way that you hear scriptures being read, the way you hear messages, the way you interact with people in your lives. It really does change that if you learn to apply what we're teaching you through this series. So in the first week, Jared taught us about how unnatural the life of Jesus was. Now, when you say that Jesus was unnatural, that sounds a little blasphemous, right? Sounds a little insulting, but it's actually an incredible compliment. So think about these phrases. Animal instinct, dog eat dog, survival of the fittest. These are phrases, these are excuses that we use to be able to put our own self-interest before others because it's only natural, right? The natural instinct of all living things is self-preservation. If it doesn't benefit me, if it's not good for my survival, if it's not good for what I want, then it can't be good, right? That's the natural way that we think of things. You know, wild animals, they take action to support their needs regardless of others. They don't ask permission. Like, think about it. So a coyote is not going to ask permission of a rat before it eats it. He's not thinking about the needs of the rat. He's thinking, I'm hungry. It's walking food. They put their needs above others. It's natural. It's how they survive. And we don't have to read too far into the Bible before we realize that that same natural instinct is part of humanity. We also have that same natural instinct. We were created in the image of God, though. And so that allows us the freedom to grow beyond the natural instinct of self-preservation. See, it's what sets us apart from the wild animals. Humans have the capacity to follow a moral compass, to be selfless, and that is unnatural. It doesn't sound easy, right? It sounds kind of impossible. We're going to get into that. Because we have an example, and that example was Jesus. So nothing that Jesus said or did was natural, right? He touched the unclean. He ate with the hated. He taught women and children. He defended the guilty. And he prayed for people while they were killing him. That's not natural. That's not putting his own self-interest before the needs of others. So that was week one. Week two, Matt dove into the concept of unnatural love. What does it look like to have unnatural love? So we look at the Sermon on the Mount, which this is Jesus' first like public speaking part of his ministry. This was the first recorded and really the only recorded sermon that we have of Jesus. And you find it in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And, you know, Jesus said some pretty crazy and natural things during this. He talked about things like, love your enemies. and pray for those who persecute you. What was Jesus doing by starting his public ministry by telling people to do things that goes against their human nature? But see, Jesus was challenging everyone to be different and set apart from the rest of the world, not through force or status, but through humble and genuine love. And that brings us to today. So today we're going to take that idea just a little bit further, and we're going to talk about unnatural service and sacrifice. So I'm going to start by reading you guys a story. So some of you probably know that I'm kind of an anthropology nerd, and there is one of the founding anthropologists in American anthropology, and she was asked a question. Her name's Margaret Mead, and she was asked a question. So years ago, anthropologist Margaret Mead was asked by a student what she considers to be the first sign of civilization in a culture. The student expected Mead to talk about fish hooks or clay pots or grinding stones. But no, Mead said that the first sign of civilization in an ancient culture was a femur or thigh bone that had been broken and then healed. See, Mead explained that in the animal kingdom, if you break your leg, you die. You can't run from danger, you can't get to the river for a drink, and you can't hunt for food. You are meat for prowling beasts. No animal survives a broken leg long enough for the bone to heal. A broken femur that has healed is evidence that someone has taken time to stay with the person that fell, has bound up the wound, has carried the person to safety, has tended the person through recovery. Helping someone else through difficulty is where civilization starts. That's a crazy thought, isn't it? So this woman that's dedicated her life to studying people and cultures, she credited civilization, what makes a civilization civilized, makes people civilized, was a broken bone that was healed. You see, we are at our best when we consider and serve the needs of others. It sets us apart from the wild animals. The capacity humans have to care for each other despite the inconvenience or sacrifice it may require is what makes us civilized. And no one has represented this as well as Jesus. All right, so you guys can flip to Luke 6. We're going to be there for just a little bit. We're going to look at the early part of Jesus' ministry. Now, this is part of a Sermon on the Mount, but it's just as it's recorded in Luke. And Jesus is teaching this very unnatural lesson. And you guys have probably heard of it. It's called the Golden Rule. Now, most people can tell you what the Golden Rule is. It's do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Simple, right? Like, if you don't want to be punched, don't punch someone. It's common sense, right? It's kind of a go-to parenting phrase. You know, I can remember as a kid my mom using it constantly to help mend relationship between me and my sister, like warning us to be nice to each other. And now that I have kids, I kind of hear myself saying that a time or two. It's good advice when you use it in the context of friend and family relationships. But today we're going to look at the context that Jesus spoke it in. Because, you know, sometimes we tend to take things and we kind of put it into our own context to how it applies to us. But we want to look at how Jesus applied it. So we're going to look back at verse 27. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Enemies? Those who hate you, who curse you, who mistreat you? Y'all, that doesn't sound like friend and family relationships to me. He's talking about it in a different context than what we're used to. It goes on. It says, if someone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other one also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Okay, Jesus, this is getting a little crazy. Treat my enemies well, despite how they treat me? Can you not just, like, give them this speech, Jesus? Can you, like, talk to the enemy and just be like, hey, you should be nice? Because obviously they're the problem, right? It's not me. Why do I even have to interact with them at all? Can I not just avoid them? Like, why do I have to be nice to them? Can I just, like, ghost them? Can I unfriend them? Can I just hang out with people that I like and agree with? In verse 32, it goes on to say, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even the sinners love those who love them. Ow. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. Ugh. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. Well, yeah, of course. Like, if I lend something to somebody, I'm lending it. Like, I expect full repayment. Like, that doesn't make me a sinner, right? No, of course not. That's just the natural way that human relationships work. You like the people that like you. You love the people that you love. You serve the people that you love. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great. And you will be children of the Most High because He is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. I imagine at that point, like, Jesus just, like, dropping the mic and, like, being like, okay, let's talk about this later. Like, here it is. Like, what you got? Because this is unnatural. This is crazy. He's saying it's not enough to love people that you like. You should love the people that you can't stand. It's not enough to love the people that are nice to you. You should love the people that are mean to you. Why? Because God is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. We were created in His image. We have the capacity to love, to put other people's needs before our own. And when we do that, we are reflecting His image. And we will be children of the Most High. That's what sets us apart from the wild animals. That's what makes us not just a group of barbarians, but a civilization of people. See, Jesus is challenging us to be unnatural. Y'all, we all know it is hard at times to show mercy and grace even to the people that we love. The reason that the golden rule is often used in friend and family relationships is because we have to be reminded to like the people that we like. But it feels impossible to show mercy and grace when we don't even like the person. But Jesus did it. You know, I could show you countless examples of, you know, we talked about what Jesus said, but saying things doesn't really matter unless you can do it, right? And I could show you countless examples of Jesus doing this. But I want to share my favorite one with you today. It's over in John 13. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. That's beautiful, right? Jesus loved the people that were with him to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Y'all, he knew his purpose. Don't miss that. He knew his purpose. So he got up from the meal. He took off his outer clothing and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Let's pause there for a minute. Jesus washed the feet of all 12 of his disciples. All of them. He knelt down. He washed off the dirt, the mud, the poo, all of the stuff that they had walked through. He cleaned them. He did it as a humble act of service without showing any bias or favoritism. He was able to do it because he knew his purpose. Y'all, I have a thing with feet. I don't like them. It's my sister's fault. I could tell you stories. I don't like feet. That's gross. Like, foot washings, gross. Like, I grew up in a church that, like, kind of did the foot washing thing occasionally. I was always sick that day. I love you guys, but unless God, like, appears to me and says, wash their feet, it's not going to happen. Like, I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. But, y'all, this story goes beyond the nastiness of feet. See, if you skip ahead to verse 11, we read that Jesus knew who was going to betray him. Y'all, Jesus knew. He knew that later that evening, Judas, his buddy Judas, that had followed him, that had lived with him, that had walked with him, had traveled with him, had ministered with him, his friend, his brother, he knew that Judas was going to tell the religious leaders that were hunting Jesus down where they could find him so they could capture him and kill him. Jesus knew. And even though he knew his purpose was greater than that moment, do you not think it would be a little hard to not leave a little extra dirt on someone's feet? To maybe be like, oh, well, that's it. The water's dirty. You're just going to have to eat with stinky feet. Put him at the end of the table. To maybe not even invite him to dinner. Jesus knew that by all definitions, his enemy was Judas. And he still washed his feet. And that is unnatural. You know, after he washed their feet, he explained why. He said in verse 13, you call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. If Jesus, their Lord and teacher, could lower himself to the position of a servant, then he expects them to be able to do the same for others. Now, this doesn't mean that anything about actually literally washing feet. We covered that. It's not going to happen. But this is an example. This is an example from a time period where that was relevant. This was our example of how we can sacrificially serve others, including our enemies. You know, if the Son of God can humble himself to serve the man that he knew was about to turn him over to be killed I think that we can learn to show basic kindness to people that we just don't agree with. But you might be thinking, yeah, of course Jesus could do this. He's Jesus. He's part God. He wasn't just a man. A regular human could not possibly show such grace and humility in the face of adversity. So there's this book I read, surprise, surprise, a while back. And it's called The Cost of Discipleship. And I want to read you guys a quote out of this book. But before I do, I want to tell you a little bit about the man who wrote it. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a pastor and an author in Germany in the early 1900s. He was an activist. He spoke out. He was safe in America when the war broke out. But he felt so strongly, and he wasn't a Jew, but he felt so strongly about what was happening in Germany that he returned to Germany to speak out against the Nazi regime. And that eventually led to his arrest and eventual execution at a concentration camp. But these are the words that he wrote. We are to serve our enemy in all things without hypocrisy and with utter sincerity. No sacrifice that a lover would make for his beloved is too great for us to make for our enemy. If out of love for our brother we are willing to sacrifice goods, honor, and life, we must be prepared to do the same for our enemy. We are not to imagine that this is to condone his evil. Such a love proceeds from strength rather than weakness, from truth rather than fear. And therefore, it cannot be guilty of the hatred of one another. And who is to be the object of such a love if not those whose hearts are stifled with hatred? You know, even after his arrest, he never stopped speaking against the Nazi regime. He never stopped standing up for the people that needed justice. But he also understood that the individual German soldier standing before him was a person that was just as much in need of God's love as he was. He could see the individual was not the group. And because of the way that he interacted with and he treated the German soldiers, his guards, he gained favor with them. And it was because of that that they preserved some of his writings. He has another book that's called The Letters and Writings from Prison. It's very reminiscent of Paul writing from prison, isn't it? You know, even facing death, he did not act hatefully toward those who were preparing to kill him. He was just a human, just like us. He was capable of showing unnatural love to his enemies. And he treated them as he wanted them to treat him. And once again, it's tempting to think, okay, that's a great story, Carrie, but that's like one of those moments in history where you're up face to face and you know who your enemy is and you know what's right and what's wrong. It's a black and white issue. It's clear. It's an extreme story from an extreme time. Now, I, as far as I know, don't have anyone that's plotting to kill me. So I don't have any, like, real enemies, like, if that's what it takes. Because the last two stories you told about Jesus and then Dietrich Bonhoeffer, like, they were nice to people that were trying to kill them. I don't have anyone that's actively trying to kill me, so I don't have any real enemies. So I'm off the hook, right? Oh, this is so relevant for our everyday lives. Think about it this way. Last week we had Project Day. We had different teams that went out and they served in different ways. We had a group go and serve a specific demographic of kids that live with food insecurities. We had a group go out and serve the needs of a widow woman that needed some help with her yard. She couldn't keep up with her yard work. And then we had a group go and serve at a nonprofit. And yeah, they served the nonprofit, but they were serving the people that served the nonprofit. Because they helped take up some of the load off of their daily work. And these are all good causes. And I'm sure that none of you would argue that we shouldn't help those groups or those people. I mean, who's going to say, no, you shouldn't help hungry kids? You shouldn't help widows in need. You shouldn't help those that are doing good things in our community. So I think we can all agree. We served good things. But I want you to all stop right now and just think for a second. Think of a group of people, an organization, an individual that stands against everything that you are for. Does everyone have someone, something? Don't say it out loud. We're not trying to cause division. Now imagine this scenario. At our next project day, we have a group that we're sending to the park with cold water and popsicles. It's in the middle of the summer, so it's hot. And we've done this before. We've handed out cold, refreshing things on a hot day at a park. And you're on that team. But when you get there, you realize that this group is having a rally there or a picnic lunch or whatever. They're there representing everything that you're against. They look hot and tired, and you have something that you could serve to them where you could make their day just a little better. Could you hand them a bottle of water? Could you walk into the middle of a group that you're not comfortable in, that you don't agree with? And can you say, would you like a blue or a red popsicle? Could you look past the group affiliation to see an individual that needs God just as much as you do? Let's take it a step further. Could you pray for them? Maybe not in that moment, but later that night when you're thinking over it and you're like, I did a good thing. I gave them some water. I did what I was supposed to do. But man, they're wrong. I think I'm going to get on Facebook and just talk about how much I hated seeing this group at the park. How it boiled my blood. How it just made me just furious. Could you recognize in that moment that the serving's not over? It's only begun. Could you stop what you're doing, put down your phone, and pray for that person? A few years ago, Liam was in preschool. And he came home one day, and at bedtime, that's usually when we talk, and I asked him, you know, what do we need to pray about today? And, or how was your day? Or something. We were just talking. And he was telling me about this little boy in his class that was being mean to him. Now, it was nothing serious. It wasn't anything to make me go to the school or anything like that. I wasn't concerned for his safety. It was more of like a hurt feeling sort of thing. But you know, it kind of made the mama bear a little cranky. I mean, how dare this little boy hurt my sweet little baby? How dare he? Please don't judge me for being a little cranky about a preschooler. Oh, we're getting to this. If you're a mom, you know. But you know what? In that moment, he was looking up at me with his little sleepy eyes. And I was like, okay, I have an opportunity here where I can try to help him work through this. But I felt powerless. I felt like there was nothing I could actually do to affect change in the situation. So I swallowed my fury, and I said, maybe we should just pray for him. So we did, and I thought that was kind of the end of it. But see, Liam doesn't forget anything. And every single night when I would say, what do we need to pray about? He would say this little boy's name, that he would be nice to me. And so every night started out, first few nights through clenched teeth and just mumbled out a prayer of, God, change this boy. Or something simple like that, like, you know, God, just help this little boy not to be a jerk. But as weeks went on and every single night consistently Liam reminded me to pray for this boy, what happened was I realized that my heart was softening for this kid. What kind of situation did he have at home that caused him to come to preschool and lash out at other kids? What could this little boy be dealing with that I have no idea about? I knew nothing about this kid. I can't even tell you what his name is now. But I found myself crying for him, my heart breaking for him. So I encouraged Liam to play with him at school, to be his friend, to show him what kindness looks like, because he may have never really experienced it before. And you know, by the end of the year, they were buddies. They played together. The bullying stopped. See, what I changed, or what I learned from this experience, is that sometimes praying for your enemies is actually not about them. It's about you. It helps you to see the individual, not the actions, the words, or any group affiliation. It opens your heart to love them. It allows you to possibly even form a relationship with them. You know, in the context of relationship, grace is more freely offered. Think about it. There are people in your life that you love, and you naturally will offer them more grace for the same things that other people that you don't know do. You know what I mean? I hope. Because when you are in a relationship with someone, when you know that person, then you can understand where they're coming from. You can understand their reasons behind what they did or what they said. You understand their motivations. And when you can understand someone's motivations, it's easier to offer them grace. But if all you know about a person is what they said or what they did or who they're affiliated with, it's a lot easier to judge their actions a lot harsher. I gotta ask you, would you want to be judged purely on your words and actions without any regard for your motivations? Would you want people to look at what you do and what you say, and that's all they see? You know, nobody likes a mean dog. A dog that growls all the time and bites without any reason. But what happens when you find out that this mean dog came from an abusive home? That he was starved, he was beaten, maybe even he was trained to fight. When you understand the context of where that dog came from, when you understand where his life started and where he is now, then you understand that when he growls for no reason, there is a reason in his mind. That when he's growling, he is trying to protect himself. He's afraid. He causes fear because of fear. But what if the dog is adopted? What if somebody shows that dog love consistently? What if they have food consistently? What if they're shown kindness and they're shown that, hands can be used for petting and not hitting? What if that dog is in a place of peace and security? The personality of the dog can change. Why? Not just because it's in a different place, but because it is experiencing love despite how it acted. You know, one thing that we say around here a lot is hurt people hurt people. The brokenness of our past often leads to the pains of our future. And we do this as an attempt of self-preservation. It's only natural. We build walls to protect ourselves. We're ready to fight. We assume the worst about people. And y'all, it's not to say that there's not some fights worth fighting. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is a great example of that. He was fighting a good fight, but he was also showing love to his enemies. But before picking a fight on Facebook that could damage relationships, better make sure that your opinion has a foundation in God's wisdom and truth. You better make sure that you're not attacking the individual. Today we're going to end service a little unnaturally. It may be a little uncomfortable. But it's not very often in our lives that we take time to just be still and listen. We're busy. We're distracted. There's always a million things to do. So we wanted to create just some space in your life today to do the unnatural thing and just sit and listen. For God, to talk to God, not to accomplish anything, not to finish a task, but to just be, to just dwell. So Matt's gonna play something softly, and I want you guys to think about a few things. You know, we can't control the behaviors and the opinions of others. We can only control how we handle it on our side. So this morning, I was kind of scrolling through Facebook, and this just happened to pop up in my newsfeed, and I was like, that's cool. There's a graphic, and it says, Jesus knew, but Judas ate too. It says, think about this for a second. Jesus knew. He goes into that room with his disciples. He knows he's going to be betrayed. He knows it is Judas who will turn against him. He knows that he has been sold out for a handful of silver, stabbed in the back by one who he has poured his life into. Yet in that room, hours before the death of Jesus, Judas ate too. Jesus fed Judas too. Jesus prayed for Judas too. Jesus washed Judas's feet too. I struggle to fathom the kind of love, a love that would feed the mouth that deceived you, a love that would wash the treasonous feet of a traitor. a love that could forgive even the vilest of betrayals. I honestly struggle to comprehend it. And then suddenly, I realize that I'm Judas. And that in that moment, I am so thankful and altogether overwhelmed that Judas ate too. We have to forgive. We have to love. Because we are forgiven and we are loved. Mark 11:25 says that when you stand praying, this was how Jesus ended one of his messages. He said, when you stand praying, if you hold anything against anyone, forgive them so that your Father in heaven may forgive you your sins. Now, this doesn't say go and reconcile. That's not a bad thing to do in all situations. But what it says here, forgive them. So today I want to ask you a question, two questions. And in this moment of just kind of stillness, I want you to answer these questions for yourself. Who is your enemy? You know, Jesus was asked the question, who's my neighbor? We're going to flip that around. It's one thing to serve someone that's different than you or that you know. It's another to think about who your enemy is. So who's my enemy? And the second question, what is God telling you to do about it?